and a very warm welcome to No Heathen Land, a podcast retelling macabre, intriguing, and just plain weird stories of the past from God's own country, Yorkshire. In my opinion, Yorkshire is the perfect breeding ground for the most weird and wonderful tales. In Yorkshire, we have the rolling, vast countryside of the Dales, dark, tangled woodlands, remote back roads, but also industry, hard labour, a history of staunch religion, farming, tight-knit communities, immigration, a welcoming attitude, intolerance, riots. Much of this documented and a vast amount not. It's the stories in between the newspaper headlines that I really want to get into. Through my experience of working in local history, it's really quite surprising how many odd tales you come across simply looking into one single person's family history. A newspaper article, a diary entry, a theatre playbill, a photograph. I'm very lucky to have made friendships and connections with interesting and enthusiastic people right here in Yorkshire. Each episode will feature one of them as a very special guest, where we'll delve into some of the stories we've come across that have fascinated, baffled, and sometimes unnerved us. Because of the subject nature of this podcast, some stories will not be suitable for everyone. Please approach with caution. Hello, and a bit more of a casual welcome to the first episode of No Heathen Land. I hope this intro finds you safe and well. If you don't know me already, I'm Sally. I'm excited and nervous to bring you this first episode. This podcast idea has been on my mind for about a year, and I've worked really hard on it. I have some wonderful guests lined up, and I hope you get as much joy from listening to them as I do. If you want to know more about the sources we've used in researching for this podcast, listen until the end of the episode where I'll be sharing where to find more. And if that's not incentive to listen, right to the bitter end, I don't know what is. I anticipate that my interviewing and editing skills will improve drastically as soon as I get some more episodes under my belt. This first one you can probably hear, my naturally excitable tone, and I promise I do calm down. So let's get on with it. My first guest, a perfect guest, I should say, is Ross Horsley, PhD, librarian, connoisseur of history and spooks, fellow cat enthusiast, and just all-round absolutely excellent person. I've been really lucky in my working life to meet fantastic people who inspire me and encourage me and make me laugh, and as a fellow spook seeker, I couldn't think of anyone better to chat with for this first episode, and you'll see why when you hear the unique tale he's chosen to share. I hope you enjoy No Heathen Land. Welcome to No Heathen Land. Welcome, Dr. Ross Horsley. I just wanted to call you Dr. Ross Horsley. Does anyone do that?
You do it.
Do you never utilise your title?
No, hardly ever. I'm trying to think the last time somebody called me Doctor. Oh, it might have been something embarrassing, like when I was on a plane or something and somebody saw
Is there a doctor on the plane?
Yeah, and I was like, oh,
and it was
not,
you.
Not a real doctor.
Well, you are a real doctor, just not a medical.
Not a plain doctor.
Yeah, exactly. I just wanted to say how we met. So we met in 2000, and I think it must have been 2014 or 13.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. So we both worked in the same library. And then in 2015, you became my manager.
I did. I was very happy about that, actually. I was
very
glad that you were coming to join my team.
Yeah. And that was the local history library. So that's how we met. And I always think that we are friends, because I hope you don't take offence to this, that everyone thinks that we're really super nice people. And I think underneath we're actually really horrible.
That's the truth.
Or we think we just like horrible things.
We do. If there's ever anything really creepy that I spot online, I have to send it to you.
Yeah. So yeah, I hope that didn't offend you, but I always say, oh yeah, I think me and Ross are friends because everyone thinks we're really nice, but we have horrible thoughts. Horrible interests. But we're not horrible people.
No way. We're super nice. I'm a doctor.
Of course. So you were the first person that I thought of when I wanted to start this podcast because of the horrible nice personness. And I knew that you'd have really good stories, like you've always got really great stories. And when you left the library service, you handed quite a bit of stuff over to me from your ghosty files.
I did, all my Yorkshire ghost stories stuff. And did you get any of the Temple Newsom stuff?
Yeah, the Lord Halifax stuff.
Because you had to go and do a talk that I'd booked in. Yeah. Oh, well, thank you for taking that one over.
It's okay. Yeah, so, I was the right person to hand it over to. And when I thought of doing this podcast, I thought the first person that I want to have a chat with is Ross. And I knew that you would probably want to hear my story as well.
Yes.
So the premise for this podcast is that I will have a guest on every episode and they will tell me a story and we'll chat about it. But in this episode, I'm also going to tell a story.
Can't wait.
As well. My story takes place in 1974, so which is quite recent. When you sort of hear what the story's about, I think it's quite shockingly recent. So this is like living memory for a lot of people. So this takes place in Ossett in West Yorkshire. So that's actually near where I am. It's not that far away. It's near Wakefield. It's classed as Wakefield. Do you know anything about Ossett?
I know nothing about Ossett. I've come across the name and wonder what it even means.
Oh, I can't tell you that. Sorry. The other thing I knew about Ossett is that it's like close. I've driven past it so many times. And there's Ossett Brewery, which is like in a lot of pubs around here. They're like owned by Ossett Brewery. So that's the only thing that I knew, really. But this story, I heard it on a podcast. So the podcast is called Unexplained. It's a British podcast. And they cover, well, the guy that presents it, he's called Richard McLean Smith. And he just covers odd stories from the past, like unexplained things. But it's things like, can be like ghostly things, or some is UFOs, or like alternate realities. There's all sorts of different things. And this was one of the first episodes. I think maybe it was like the third or something.
Right.
And when I heard it, and I realised how close it was and how recent it was, like it kind of scared me because it's quite scary, and I had to listen to it a couple of times, but I've just been fascinated with it ever since. I think this was maybe in like 2017 that I listened to it, and I've just thought about it loads since. And when I thought of the idea for this podcast, I was like, that's the story that I want to tell. And then since then, I've heard it on the True Crime Enthusiast podcast, and I think it was their first episode, which is something that I don't really listen to be honest, but I quite enjoyed it, the one that I listened to. And then it was covered on the very famous American podcast, Last Podcast on the Left. So they covered it too, which again kind of blew my mind because that's one of the biggest podcasts in the world. Mm-hmm. And they covered this story from this tiny town that's like, you know, 20 minute drive from me. So it's a small place. It's a market town, and it was made up of small mines and mills, and according to local historian John Goodchild, it was typical of towns up until the late 60s, and he said it was small mines, small mills. So I'm not going to go into too much detail, even though I did go like down a really like long rabbit hole about Ossett, but I didn't find out what what the name means. It's worth making a point that in the 70s, particularly in Yorkshire, the north of England generally is remembered as being pretty bleak. Mm-hmm. Like lots of unemployment, pit and factory closures, not really the greatest of times to be in Yorkshire. I mean, when I was down this rabbit hole, I read that might not necessarily be true in like economic stat terms. Really? But I think the way that it was portrayed and the winter of discontent, which was at the end of the 70s, wasn't it? Pretty bleak. So the subject of this story is a man called Michael Taylor, who's 31. In 1974, and he was a father of five.
Gosh.
So, yeah, this seems like a lot of kids for 31-year-olds, doesn't it? And they were all boys as well.
Really?
All boys. Yeah, yeah. And he was married to a woman named Christine. So he was described as a mild-mannered man. There's really not a whole lot of information about him as a person. Unsurprising, to be honest, from the 70s. But from what was reported, he's mild-mannered, nice family man. Didn't kick up too much of a fuss about anything in particular. But what we do know about the family is that they didn't go to church.
Okay.
So whilst it's not like groundbreaking 1970s news that they didn't go to church, it's not like the 1800s they didn't go to church, it's a little bit unusual, especially for a small town. And it does kind of come, well, it does come back on itself, this like him not going to church thing. So I think it's quite important to the story later on. But the thing about Michael is that he suffered from chronic back pain from an injury, and apparently suffered from bouts of what they called mild depression. Oh. So sort of coming and going bouts of mild depression, but that's, you know, that's what's reported from various people who might not have known him very well. It's kind of unclear, but what is a fact is that he struggled to hold down any kind of work because of this back pain, which like obviously exacerbated this depression. So does that set the scene?
Yeah.
Can you picture yourself in 1974 Osset?
Do you know, it's actually really interesting that you mentioned the whole kind of the influence that the church still has, because I was born in the 70s and I was christened, but my family aren't particularly religious, but you know, at that point in time it was still considered important enough to have me christened.
Yeah. So this person, a neighbour of theirs called Barbara Wiseman, and I've put in brackets nosy because it's reported that she noticed apparently that he was in a bit of a depressive state and basically kind of went round and said, "You need Jesus."
Okay.
So she introduced them to a newfangled Christian fellowship in the area. So they would meet in homes around the town. It was like this cool new Christian fashion. And I found out that this kind of Christianity was known as charismatic Christianity.
Charismatic?
Yeah. So they would go to the congregation members' houses, and they would do the congregations there, and they would chat, and they would have a lovely time and do all sorts of different rituals, which will become clear later on. So the fellowship was run by a 21-year-old woman called Marie Robinson. And from the podcast that I listened to, it's quite clear that this particular fellowship and this particular like branch of Christianity, if this story hadn't have turned out the way that it did, it might have become some kind of cult.
Gosh.
So I don't know how much you know about cults, but female cult leaders and female serial killers are infinitely more successful than male ones. So whereas there's not more, female cult leaders and serial killers tend to be much more successful because they're a lot more subtle.
Wow.
Yeah. There's a little snippet for you there. So apparently this is like the Four Square services in the US, which I'd never heard of, but it makes sense. So the Four Square services were highly theatrical, with lots of healing and speaking in tongues. So it's like this real sort of like theatre.
Right.
And imagine in 1974, the bleak north, Osset town. This is probably pretty exciting.
Yes.
Whether you thought it was sort of entertainment or you really believed in it. So they were invited along to one of these meetings. And in the first meeting that they went to, there was a woman from the town called Mavis Smith. And she was sat on her own and she was really tearful, seemed really upset. And she was crying. And this was the first one that Michael and his wife, Christine, both attended together. They didn't take their children. And the leader of the fellowship, Marie Robinson, started speaking in tongues to this older lady, Mavis Smith. Mavis Smith started speaking back to her in tongues and was like writhing around, having a really mad time of it. And this didn't really seem to come to any kind of conclusion, and they ended up just stopping. And this poor woman didn't really seem to recover from it and was never sort of the same again after that. So we don't know what was going on with her or why she was sort of responding in this way, but she it kind of changed her demeanour and she was never quite the same after that. That's what was reported. So Michael and Christine ended up loving this fellowship. Michael in particular loved the fellowship. And, oh, we have a cat visitor.
Just sneaking past.
He's just coming around the back of the sofa. So, yeah, they really got into it, and they actually even started holding some of the fellowship meetings in their own house.
Right.
Presumably while their five children were there. It's never actually reported what on earth the kids, the five boys were doing at this time, who were presumably very young as well. So this fellowship, they were meeting in all their homes and in Michael and Christine's home. But it was becoming clear that Michael Taylor was becoming quite besotted with Marie Robinson. So he's a 31-year-old man, she's a 21-year-old woman. And it sort of has been suggested that, with this like cult leader sort of thing, that she was using her good looks, which apparently she had, and influence to try and, maybe manipulate is the right word, but to coax people into thinking that what she was doing was right, or what she was doing was a good thing, or was believable. There was lots of talk in the fellowship meetings about the devil, about Satan. They apparently believed that when the moon was full, that was the devil, and you had to sort of pray that away. So after a while, Christine Taylor, the wife of Michael, started to become disillusioned with the group. A lot of this was because Michael was paying a lot of attention to Marie Robinson. And they actually started meeting up on their own to apparently just do signs of the cross at each other. And there was several occasions where Christine Taylor walked in on her husband with his hands on Marie's shoulders, staring deeply into her eyes.
Gosh.
But apparently it was just for Jesus. So there's that. they started having private meetings together and do the signs of the cross, and they believed that when the moon was full, it was evil. So there you go. So Christine eventually had enough, and everyone noticed that there was like this sexual tension between Michael and this congregation leader, Marie. So Christine, in one of the fellowship meetings at their house, just called them out on it.
Wow.
In front of everyone. And apparently this was like an unsaid thing. Everyone knew that something was going on. But she was like, today's the day. But what she suggested was that they go upstairs, the two of them go upstairs and resolve the issue while the congregated waited for them downstairs.
Gosh.
Yeah, which I've just written, terrible idea. So we do have Marie's account of this. So Marie is still with us.
Right.
Apparently, no one knows where she went after this particular story, but she there's police reports from what happened later on. So Marie claimed that when they did go away alone upstairs, Michael tried to kiss her. She rejected him, said, "You should go back to your wife."
Mm-hmm.
So at first he accepted it, apparently, and he came out of the room and said, "It's all right, everyone, come back upstairs." But then he exclaimed to everyone in the fellowship, "A miracle has happened. We have both overcome our passions." But apparently it was pretty one-sided. So the mood sort of settled then. And Michael sort of left the room. And at this point, apparently, was when Michael's personality started to shift. And when he came back, he stared Marie in the eyes. And Marie described his look as becoming bestial and inhuman. And as soon as she saw a change in his eyes, she fell back and began shouting at him in tongues. This was in front of everyone in this fellowship, in his house as well. So she was screaming at him in tongues from on the floor. And instead of sort of lunging at her or doing what you think, he started doing exactly the same back. So he also fell back and started screaming at her in tongues. But then, so in Michael's report later on, he would say, at this point, he saw Marie standing naked in front of him, and he was naked, and then he blacked out.
But this was in his head.
In his head, because what actually happened was that he started slapping Marie, pulled her hair in front of everyone in the congregation, and they try to sort of hold him back, and he's screaming in tongues, and they finally manage to pull him away. So Marie was obviously terrified, and they called the police, but nothing came of it in the end. Everyone went home. But fortunately, that is not the end of the story. So would this have happened if Marie had not found suggestible people and opened their minds to the idea of the devil and exorcism, and the apparent like presence mm-hmm. of the devil? I don't know. But basically, the next day after this had happened, the 21-year-old fellowship leader Marie turned up at Michael and Christine's house and said, "I forgive you." And Christine asked her to leave.
Which had a point.
Yeah. So what happened in the interim doesn't really isn't reported for reasons which will become clear later. But obviously there would have been, you know, harsh words said mm-hmm. and whether things were going to get resolved. He obviously said that he couldn't remember what happened, and why everyone was sort of, you know, word gets around about yeah. things like that. So Michael's demeanour didn't change, and he was still very sombre and started doing sort of adopting manic behaviours and destroyed all religious iconography in his home. So things like crosses, became very annoyed about them, wouldn't go anywhere near them. And he began like skulking around outside his house and telling other neighbours that he had seen the devil. And obviously this didn't go unnoticed, and people started to gossip, and in a small town everyone found this kind of stuff out pretty quickly. So I should mention that this whole story takes place over the course of 2 months. So it's really, really short amount of time. So a local priest at St. Thomas in Gorba, which is in Barnsley. So I'm from Barnsley and I kind of know where this is, and it's not that far away from Ossett, but it's fair enough. So yes, this local priest heard about Michael, and he's called Reverend Peter Vincent, and apparently he was a renowned exorcist for the Anglican Church, and he decided that he was going to come and pay Michael a visit.
I didn't even know they had exorcists.
Apparently, so in Barnsley they did. There was a need them. So when he did pay him a visit, Michael claimed that Marie was the one who had corrupted him, tried to seduce him, and she was actually a closet Satanist. Yeah. And he believed that a demon had been planted in him by Marie. And Christine and the Reverend agreed. So they kind of said, that makes total sense. And poor Christine, you can kind of see why she would believe that and want to believe that, that her formerly loving, mild-mannered husband had become this different person. And it was because of this terrible woman, basically.
And her demons.
And her demons. Her planted demons.
Yes.
So, they had actually planned to go on a little holiday as a family to recoup after everything that had been going on, which sounds like a good idea. And Reverend Peter Vincent kind of said, "Ooh, maybe we should exorcise these demons before you think about doing anything like that." And guess who was tasked to get the tailors to go to this exorcism? It was a woman from the beginning. It was a nosy neighbour, Barbara Wiseman.
I knew she was going to come back into it at some point.
Yeah. So what's weird about this is that she's mentioned in it in the beginning and in this bit too, but she seems to have come out of it unscathed. Like, from what happens in this story in a few moments, it's so strange that you don't hear from the people in the story because it was so recent. So they managed to convince Michael and Christine knew what was happening, to go and see the Reverend at his church. I think from how the story pans out, he must have lived like joined the church. So he went to his house in the evening to have tea, but no one had told Michael what the plan was for this evening. And the secret plan was an exorcism. Yay! Yeah, I've written yay!
Yay!
Yay! Okay, so when they went to the Reverend's house, as soon as he realised what was about to happen, Michael threw his tea in the Reverend's face. which in the American podcast of this, they made a big deal about. Apparently, we don't throw tea. We definitely do. And it's 1,000 degrees. Yeah, so he threw his tea in the Reverend's face and kicked his cat.
Oh.
And then punched the Reverend in the face.
God.
I mean, it's kind of justified. Can you imagine, you know, going to someone's house for tea and then being like,
actually,
exorcism time. So basically, Michael had to be restrained. And the reports had said that he was tied to the floor, which I can't quite understand. One of the reports said that he had to be put into like an office room and like locked in with some cushions on the floor. But I don't know how you tie his tied. Maybe he was tied to the cushions or something. I don't know. I just find that quite odd that they managed to tie him to the floor. But they had to wait till midnight. So I don't know what time they went. Because you think, oh, they'd go like six.
This could be quite a long time.
But I think he was waiting for a long time before it was midnight. Because apparently that's when you start an exorcism. There we go. Right, so the Reverend and his cronies it was believed that he had 40 demons.
Gosh, that's specific.
Yeah, they included bestiality, heresy, incest, and most importantly, lust. So they ripped the crucifix from round his neck and burnt it. And then every time he screamed or spoke in tongues, they would shove a crucifix into his mouth. And this went on for 8 hours. So he was exercised for 8 hours.
From midnight 8 a.m.
until 8 a.m. So when it was finished, it wasn't finished, because apparently after these 8 hours, there were still 3 demons left in him. And those demons were anger, insanity, and murder.
Oh.
So they're three quite significant demons to be left in a person's body that you know you're pretty worried about. And so this next bit is where it gets really quite, if that's not scary enough, it's going to get worse.
Wow.
So they went home, and for some reason, I mean, I don't know how this worked out like this. Christine had asked a friend to take their 5 boys for the night.
Right.
Which is good, given what happens next. And I've just wrote that. Kind of seems like a miracle that happened. But whether the thing that happens next would have happened if the children were there, I don't know. There were reports the next day in the town of a man walking around naked, covered in red paint.
Oh dear, this is not...
Yeah.
This does not bode
well.
And
a couple of people recognised him as Michael Taylor. And so the police came onto the scene and got out of the car, walked over to this man covered in red paint that was Michael Taylor, and realised that it wasn't red paint, it was blood, and he was covered in head-to-toe blood. And if you think about someone thinking that must be paint...
The amount of it.
Yeah. And they said, "Whose blood is that?" And he kept repeating, "It is the devil's blood. It is the devil's blood." Yeah.
That's the horror movie trailer right there.
It's so scary. And again, it just gets worse. So I'm sorry. It's a horrible story. So he's arrested and taken into custody. And the first thing that the police do is go and check on his wife, Christine, who unfortunately is dead. But the way that she was killed is really, really terrifying. And the reason why they think that Michael Taylor was possessed with something other than just sort of like a jealous scorn, rage, anger.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where the connection between these 3 demons that were apparently left in him come into play. So it's a content warning now. I think I'm going to put the content warning before this episode. It's quite horrible. So Christine's tongue was ripped out and her eyes were gouged out. Michael also ripped their tongue and eyes from their little poodle dog. And he'd clawed at her and ripped off the whole of her face.
Oof.
So the whole house was just covered in blood and body parts. And the police that went onto the scene had basically said afterwards, like, they would never recover from this, and they didn't think that they would ever see anything like that. It's just awful. So Michael claims to have no recollection of this whatsoever. He knew that he'd killed his wife because he was told that's what he'd done. And what do you think might have happened next?
Well, I hope that the children are taken away to safety.
Don't have any information about them, but you would hope so, and I hope they're all okay.
Yeah.
Because they're probably, you know, alive and kicking. I hope they are somewhere.
Well, I presume so. They're born in what, the 60s and early 70s, maybe?
Yeah, so this was 1974. So he went to trial and was not convicted by reason of insanity.
Right.
And he went to Broadmoor Psychiatric Facility. He did 2 years there, and then 2 years in Bradford, and then he was released.
Gosh.
Yeah. And that's kind of the end of the story.
But what about Marie?
Never to be heard from again. I mean, you could probably look into her and find her. She's probably an ancestry or find my past. We don't know. I mean, yeah. So obviously she was blamed by him and was initially blamed by poor Christine for this change in him. And, you know, did she put the idea of Satan in his head? Mm-hmm. Was he actually possessed with 40 demons? Did he miss those three out and that's what caused it? I think it's like the brutality of the murder that is so unbelievably shocking. Mm-hmm. There was no murder weapon. So it was all done by hand. I know that they say that, like, actually, if you bite your own finger off, it's just like biting through a carrot.
Oh, but, I've not heard that before. You know, no.
I think that's true. But it's your reflexes that stop you doing it.
Yeah.
So it's probably quite hard to pull someone's tongue out, but not impossible. But imagine the kind of, like, blind rage that you would have to feel.
Absolutely.
That's happened. So there's a couple of theories of things that might have happened. Mm-hmm. Aren't demonic possession, if you don't believe in that. So one of them is hysterical pseudopsychosis, and that was apparently, I think this was what he was diagnosed with and in the psychiatric unit. So when he was having his exorcism, hyperventilated, and it caused like an onset psychosis, which basically made him black out and in this horrendous rage. I think that's that's as scientific as I'm going to get. But in the first podcast where I heard this and unexplained, the guy that presents it brings up the quantum mind, which is really fascinating. And I guess it's kind of like the pseudo psychosis. So the quantum mind in the thinnest of terms, because I'm not a scientist. Can you believe it? So quantum mind is the unconscious mind as a primary mode.
What does that mean?
So it means the things that you would usually keep as like a repressed thought are at the front.
Okay.
So, you know, like, I'm probably going to show myself up here. When you run on the bus and you're like, what'd happen if I just like got up and kicked someone in the face? Or like, what if, that kind of thing, like that really impulsive thing that you're like, well, you're never going to do it. But apparently the quantum mind is where that's at the front.
Right.
So it's like the completely irrational thoughts, but they're carried out. So he could potentially have had no impulse control because what he's acting out is actually his subconscious.
Mm-hmm.
That's why he's saying he can't remember it.
You have to wonder how much the other people involved kind of, for want of a better word, triggered this kind of episode.
Yeah.
I mean, the clergyman, the other cult members, if we're going to call them that. Yeah. I mean, where do you go with your cult after this happens?
So the reverend that did the exorcism, he got promoted after this. He didn't stop practicing. He became a priest. Or is it a vicar? Whichever one. I don't know. I'm not religious. Whichever one's higher. Anyway, he was promoted.
I wasn't going to say based on this. Probably not based on this. But that's probably what obviously didn't detract from it.
Mm, yeah. So it brings up all kinds of things like the ethical issues mm-hmm. of exorcism and religion. I mean, what these people probably needed is a good old bit of therapy, or people like Marie Robinson. However young she was, she obviously knew that these people in this small town that didn't have access to, you know, like worldly things, maybe didn't have a lot of money, maybe had a bad family life. maybe unemployed, they need something to cling to. Mm-hmm. And if that is believing in the devil and thinking that Jesus is going to save you, then maybe that's enough. But I'm not sure how they all felt after this had happened.
Well, yeah, I mean, you sort of made the point that people might have joined this church almost for a bit of entertainment in a way. But then something like this happens, and I mean, you go from wanting something exciting to happen to the horror that must have actually, you know, rocked this town.
Yeah, and it seemed like it turned from being like this, oh, there's a bit of a love triangle going on here, to, oh, he's ripped her face off
oh,
now.
God.
The end. So, yeah, that's my fave Yorkshire story.
So, I guess the fact that you live so close to this area.
Yeah. I did, yesterday when I was doing some research, I did think, oh, maybe I could drive over. I'm like, that's a bit too far.
I'm guessing the places, you know, the house, any church or anything that came into it, well, probably still there.
I think the church is probably still there. Yeah, it's, I think it really struck me because it's such a horrible story. I'd never heard of it.
I've not.
Like, I'm probably not as much as you, but I'm fairly up on, like, weird stuff.
This is surprising, isn't it?
But that's never popped up for me.
Yeah, I mean, just in terms of, I mean, you take the sort of slightly spooky angle out of it, you've still got a really graphic and memorable murder that you almost think you might have heard of.
Yeah.
I'm glad it's your favourite, anyway. I'm glad I've heard this story.
Yeah. So I didn't think that I could really top that at the moment. So that's my first story. Welcome to the podcast.
And what a welcome! Have you ever seen photographs of any of the people who were involved?
There is a photograph from a newspaper article. So there is going to be a Twitter page for this podcast, and I might post some stuff on my own Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
So at the beginning or the end of this, I will say something about the handle, which is not created yet because this podcast isn't out yet. But there will be stuff. Yes, yeah, so I'll post them on there. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of good blog posts. There's a picture of him from the newspaper. It's very grainy.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a picture of his wife as well. I think there is. Oh, so maybe I should have added this at the end. Michael Taylor actually came back into the public consciousness in 2005.
Really?
Yeah, because he was arrested for indecently assaulting a 15-year-old girl.
Mm.
But again, nothing came of that. And apparently he has made several suicide attempts. But as far as I'm aware, he's still alive, but is very much under the radar.
Gosh.
Elsewhere. But yeah, I guess he'd be in his 70s
yeah,
now.
Yeah, he's going to be getting on a little bit now, isn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah. But as for the other people, there really isn't much. But you could probably keep digging and find and find some stuff.
Well, that's it. And the fact that, it, as you pointed out, it's also in living memory. I mean, there are people around, maybe even in the area, who will remember this very clearly.
Yeah.
Which
very
is
scary stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My story that I'm going to share with you, again, it's the first one that popped into my head when you mentioned that you were doing this podcast. But unlike yours, it's more of a kind of story that is passed around by people. So I've not really been able to trace who or why this kind of legend, for want of a better word, got started. But I did find something in the newspaper that I think might have been part of the inspiration for it, and that was in the Leeds Mercury in 1761, so I'll share that with you later on. But in terms of the story I think goes back to the 1920s, so this is a time when, which you'll know from the kind of Yorkshire ghost story stuff and the Temple Newton articles that we used to read and do talks on, and this was a time when people were very much into their ghost stories, and they would meet to tell their ghost stories. You know, Christmas time was a big time when people would gather round and listen to ghost stories, so, you know, that was a really, I guess, a popular form of entertainment at the time. But this particular ghost story seems to have only been told in Leeds. And I think that that's because it was tied to a certain object. And the tradition of the story, or the way the story was told, was that somebody would present this object to you and then tell you the story that went along with it. So I've got an object for you.
Oh my God!
It's not the object, but it's, I hope, illustrates the object. So what do you think the object is?
So this is, Ross has handed me this, And this is a tankard.
Correct, exactly.
With a wooden style handle.
Yep.
There you go.
That's very nice sound. The real tankard was made of silver. I'm not sure if that was the sound of silver. It's possibly the sound of pewter. And on the bottom is what?
On the bottom it says 99p. It's from Oxfam.
Yes. I bought this at the weekend in Bradford. And actually, it all went a bit wrong because when I took it to the counter, the guy got really excited. And he sort of mimed filling it up with beer for me and said, "Would you like a refill, sir?" And I sort of played along and said, "Oh, thank you. What a hot day. Yes, I love a refill." But then we kind of realised we'd kind of gone too far with the joke and everything we did after that was a bit weird. So, yeah, the transaction just went really embarrassing.
You had to just carry on acting like you were in a pub.
Yeah.
Like, can I use terrible. Your toilet?
Oh, God.
Do I need to sit outside?
And then, of course, I had to pay for it with, like, my card, and it was this 99p tankard. And it, yeah. And if you look inside it, it's quite grim. I think it's, like, spider's legs and some dust. And I was thinking, oh, this guy thinks I'm seriously going to drink from this. But anyway, here it is, in your hands. It's a tankard. Mm-hmm. So imagine yourself back in the 1920s. You get presented with this tankard, and you're told that this is a gift to you, and it will bring you luck, especially of the financial variety. So it's a good thing to have. But the story goes that along with the tankard comes something of a curse. In fact, the curse comes in the shape of a ghost. Sally's moving this tankard further and further away from her. The story itself is called the Fortune Teller's Tankard for reasons that will become clear. So yeah, you'd be presented with this tankard. It was a bit of a beaten old weathered tankard, quite a few dents in it and scratches. That's because, you know, maybe it goes back to the 1700s, this story. Maybe this tankard, well, not this tankard, but maybe that tankard, you know, was a couple hundred years old by the time this story was being told. So, yeah, the only way to kind of not be haunted too badly by the ghost that came along with the tankard was to bury it. Bury it outside your house. You'd hopefully still benefit from the luck, but you wouldn't be visited by the ghost, or at least you hoped, because it started to be rumoured that even if you did keep the tankard buried in your garden, the ghost would still visit you. And it was a particularly frightening and strange looking ghost because it had a huge golden grin. So this grin, you'd be able to see it in the shadows, in the darkness of your bedroom at night, and just that's all you'd see, this glowing grin and maybe a sort of scary shadowy outline. But anyway, would you like to hear the story of the tankard itself and how it came to be haunted?
As yes,
it were?
Please.
Okay, well, it's called the Fortune Teller's Tankard. And the story starts, and I think quite appropriately, on a very dark and stormy night, actually on Woodhouse Ridge somewhere. So we're in the mid to late 1700s, a dark, cold, freezing, windy, rainy night on Woodhouse Ridge. There's a little cottage there, quite a nice little cottage. It belongs to the gamekeeper. But the gamekeeper isn't home. Only his wife is home this night, this dark and stormy night. He's off keeping the game or whatever they do. I don't really know.
Looking after the game.
He's looking after the game. Out at night, she's home alone. She's listening to the sounds of the storm. She's huddled up under a blanket, maybe. She hears the one sound she doesn't want to hear on this night.
Oh, my God.
And that is knock, knock. But do you think it was going to be something worse?
Just like, what's with a child's laugh?
Okay, there's quite a lot of things that could have been worse. A blood-curdling scream,
no, that's
a gunshot.
That's pretty scary.
Yeah, it's bad enough. It's knock, knock, knock on the door on this awful night and she's all alone. So she goes open, she opens the door a little bit and she peeps through the crack and she sees an old lady.
Don't let her in. Sorry, love.
And actually, she recognises this lady. Everybody calls her the Witch of the Woods.
Amazing.
But the gamekeeper's wife actually knows her a little bit as well. In fact, she knows her as Old Sal. This is just a coincidence.
Oh, I don't know if I've said, but my name's Sally. Oh, I think I probably would have Sal. Said at the beginning. Yeah, that's so, just as an aside, a very select few people can call me Sal.
What about Old Sal?
That's fine. Sorry, please continue.
So anyway, on the doorstep is Old Sal. And the gamekeeper's wife, she's you know, she's kind of relieved in a way, because even though this is still a bit strange, and looking out into the darkness behind you, and it's a horrible night, she thinks, well, Old Sal wouldn't be here unless she had some important business to kind of attend to. So she bids her welcome. So old Sal, covered in a big cloak and hood, shuffles into the room. She pulls her a chair up next to the fire. She gets her mug of cocoa. And old Sal says, "You must cross my palm with silver, for I have important news." So the woman thinks, okay. She goes over to a little brick by the fireplace, pulls it out, and there's a little box with some money inside, a little tin box with some money kept behind the brick. And the fortune teller says, "Put 6 silver shillings in my palm." So the gamekeeper's wife counts out the money into her palm, and then the fortune teller closes her palm, and she opens it again, and there's just 1 shilling left in her palm. So, you know, at this point, 5 shillings have gone missing. That's a fair bit of money back in these days, but the gamekeeper's wife, you know, she thinks, okay, keep calm. I'm not here to be swindled. There's something more important going on here. And sure enough, old Sal says, "Even the 1 shilling that remains, you'll be glad to give me when I tell you of the fortune that is coming your way if you follow my instructions." So the gamekeeper's wife is very, very intrigued by this point, so she's listening intently. And the fortune teller says, "Tomorrow, after sunrise, you must go out to the close by the mill pond and look for the molehill. And if you dig up this molehill, you will find a silver tankard full of gold coins." So, wow, you can imagine this is really exciting news for the gamekeeper's wife. So the rest of the night, she cannot sleep a wink. And in the morning, when the weather's cleared up a little bit, the rain's stopped, and her husband gets back, she says, "I've got some great news, you know. I can't really... The old lady who told me I can't tell you anything about it, otherwise the charm will be broken, but we're going to come into some money." And the gamekeeper himself says, "Old lady..." And he says, "That's a bit strange." And he reaches into his bag and he pulls out a silver tankard. And by this point, the gamekeeper's wife is thinking, what on earth is going on here? And the gamekeeper says, "Well, last night in the middle of the storm, me and my apprentice, Bill, were walking past the cottage of the Witch of the Woods. And we noticed that the door was banging open in the wind. So we went and had a look. We peered in through the darkness. Couldn't see much. We went over to the bed in the corner and there was a huddled up shape wrapped in blankets. When we unwrapped a little bit, we realised it was the body of the witch. She'd clearly been dead for a few days. The flies had got in, the crows had got in. It wasn't a pretty sight. We knew that no one would miss her. It's not as if the priest is going to come down and say a few words or anything. So we decided the best thing to do was to bury her under the cypress tree out where she lives." And the woman thinks, "Oh my goodness, so old Sal has actually been dead for several days, and yet I saw her last night. It must have been a ghost that came to let me know of you know, her fortune that she had, that she wanted to pass on to me." But then she looks at the empty tankard on the table between them, and she says, "But what's this got to do with anything?" And the gamekeeper says, "Well, after we buried the body, and we were just about to leave the house, I saw this sitting on the table, and you know, I figured it's worth a bit of money and nobody else would be looking for it, so I brought it home for us." And the gamekeeper's wife says, "Oh no, that's so stupid. What, your actions here might have cheated us out of a huge fortune." So she's really mad. She storms out. She rushes down to the mill pond. Sure enough, she sees a large molehill. So she goes over to the molehill. She realises she hasn't brought a spade or anything, so she just has to start digging in the soil. And as she digs for a little bit, her fingers touch something cold and smooth. It might be the tankard. So she digs a little bit more, but then she realises that it's not metal at all. It's actually cold, dead flesh. That was a well-timed scream. She thinks, oh no, it must be the body of old Sal. But it's not. She looks a little bit closer, that the skin is unwrinkled. It's the skin of a young person. And in fact, as she gingerly kind of pulls the soil back a little bit further, she realises it's a young man. She recognises the young man. It's her husband's apprentice, Bill. And as the soil crumbles away, she sees a massive slash across his throat, and spilling out from his neck are dozens of golden coins. She can't believe this. She recoils and she stands up in horror. And she feels somebody behind her. And she turns around and it's her husband. And he takes her in his arms and he says, so you found it then? And she says, I don't understand. What is this? What's happening? And he says, don't worry, my dear. I did this for us. It was Bill that found the tankard, and the tankard was full of gold coins, but he refused to split them with me. And I knew we needed them. So I'm afraid that killing him was the only way that I could, that we could start our life with this fortune. And he takes a, with his left hand, he takes a face in his hand. And with his right hand, he swings a silver tankard towards her head and smashes it into the side of her skull. And that's the last thing she ever sees, that flicker of silver. And then you with your tankard in the 1920s look down at it and you look at those dents and those scratches and think, do I want to keep this tankard? Do you want to keep this tankard?
I mean, I'm genuinely scared of the tankards. That was such a good story. I loved it. The way that you told that was so scary.
Well, obviously I'm glad. But actually, I did hear a little bit more from... there was, obviously, as the legend grew and this tankard went round from people, people started to talk about the ghosts that they'd seen. So people would often see this ghost with the golden grin, but some would look further into the darkness behind the figure, and they'd see another ghost behind there, and it would be the ghost of an old lady with a hood up and an upturned palm. And some would even look further into the shadows, and they'd see yet another ghost behind that, the ghost of a very sad-looking woman who was cheated out of a fortune. And if you looked even further, deeper into the darkness of the room, it was rumoured that you might see a glint of silver as something whistled towards you in the dark.
I love that. That was so good. I've never heard that before. It's really interesting.
I've been really digging around to try and find out where this story comes from. And as I say, I did find a little story in the Leeds Mercury. This was me doing my ancestry search. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the Leeds Mercury, December the 1st, 1761. So it says, on the 19th ultimo, have you ever heard that before?
No.
I hadn't either. Ultimo means of last month. Oh. So, on the 19th, oh, ultimo.
Going to use that.
I know.
Every month.
Yeah. On the 19th, ultimo, the following affair happened at Woodhouse in this parish. A fortune teller went to the house of John Gelded, a journeyman stuff weaver in that village, and offered to tell his fortune. He consenting, she ordered him to put 50 shillings into her hand, which she said he should hold fast while she repeated her charm. I don't know why it's 50 shillings. That sounds like a lot of money to me. But yeah. Anyway, on opening her hand, she had but 1 shilling and 6 pence left, which she likewise said he would not refuse to give her for her trouble when he was informed of the approaching good fortune. This was that on the Thursday following, he would find, in digging up a molehill in a close adjoining the house, a silver tankard full of gold. So here we go. This must be the source of this legend. Also, that he must on no account mention the affair till the day appointed. If he did, the whole charm would be broke. But the youth was so flushed with the hope of receiving his money again with such exorbitant interest that the next day he disclosed the secret. And though since then he has dug up all the molehills in the neighbourhood, he can find neither the tankard nor the money.
Damn.
Typical, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I think this ghostly legend possibly arose from this strange little quirky incident.
Yeah.
In Woodhouse, of all places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So for someone that didn't know what Woodhouse was or what Woodhouse Ridge was like, how would you describe it?
Well, I think it's quite an interesting name. And I must admit, I only really started exploring it during lockdown, you know, when everybody was going for walks all the time. So I'd heard of Woodhouse Ridge and I'd heard it had quite interesting views of the city and that it was big enough to have woods and a bandstand. And I kind of couldn't imagine it. But yeah, basically, it's the bit between what we call Hyde Park and Woodhouse and what I guess is Meanwood on the other side. So there's not really any big roads. There's lots of old houses, lots of kind of ginnels. And the woods themselves.
A perfect place for a ghost story.
A perfect place for a ghost story.
Mm, especially when the weather's dark and stormy.
I wonder what happened to the actual tankard. I mean, what I guess actually happened is that the, you know, the novelty wore off the story. Everybody had heard it. But somebody somewhere ended up with that tankard, I suppose.
It could be this one.
It could be this one.
I'll put a picture of this on the Twitter.
Oh, you have to.
Yeah, there really is a tankard here. Betwixt us.
I was tempted to do that little tapping noise of it again, you know, because that would obviously prove that I've got a silver tankard in my hand.
I think if you clean that up, it would be quite lovely.
Well, I'll leave that for you to do. Or bury it in the garden, whichever.
I don't know what would be the best thing to do with it. Throw it into the canal. But yeah, I mean, isn't burying it a bad thing, though, from what you said in the story?
Well, it just certainly didn't work, because the ghost would still seemingly appear, so I guess it was the first line of defence. I mean, maybe you could bury it in somebody else's garden.
Oh, great idea. You know, it made me think of the burying thing. It made me think of that, what's it called? The Sam Raimi film with the old lady and she
keeps... Oh, yes. Oh, what's it called?
And she keeps coming back.
Yes.
Drag Me to Hell. Drag Me to Hell. Yeah. That's the one.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that has a bit of a unfortunate... Oh, and this is such a spoiler, but yeah, it doesn't exactly have a happy ending.
It's been out for years.
Yeah, true.
If you haven't watched it, what are you doing?
Yeah, and if you have watched it, then just watch it again. What are you doing?
That was great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I think on the podcast, to lighten the mood after the stories, because I think, well, mine particularly was pretty horrible and yours was just spooky. In case people listen to this before they go to bed, I thought I'd do a little culture corner.
Oh.
Culture corner. I'm not going to use that.
Good, because I thought you were asking me to sing then for a moment.
Yeah, I have to sing with the guest every episode. Yeah, I just thought it would be quite nice to hear what kinds of things you've been doing. What have you been listening to? What have you been watching? Where have you been? Like, yeah. In England, lockdown has pretty much fully lifted-ish. Mm-hmm. So we're allowed back out again. We can do stuff and go see things. Mm-hmm. And Ross, I would consider Ross an aficionado of horror films. And I will always go and ask Ross if he's seen a horror film and what he thinks is good. So I'm hoping that you've got a good recommendation or something that you've watched recently.
Well, the first thing I did when lockdown lifting actually was go to the cinema to see a horror film. And I enjoyed it, actually. It was The Unholy. Oh. So it's based on a James Herbert. I think it's based on The Shrine of his. It's not an amazing film at all, but I think the novelty of going to see a film in the cinema was just... a horror film, even, mm-hmm. in the cinema... was just so full on that I was quite happy to be sitting there in the familiar darkness with this slightly cheesy but enjoyable horror film on the big screen. And that's still out, I think, at the moment, because I imagine now that once a film gets released in the cinemas, it's probably going to be out for, like, months. We used to get a couple of weeks, didn't we, sometimes?
Yeah.
Whereas at the moment, I guess if you're somebody who values cinema, you probably want to go out and support it a little bit. So, yeah, I've been to see Cruella and the new Ghibli film.
I didn't know that there was one.
Well, yeah, have you heard of it? It's called Earwig and the Witch.
No.
Oh, yeah, so it's Miyazaki's son has made it, and I'm not sure they truly get on. And this is a different style. It's very much computer animation compared to the beautiful, you know, kind of hand-drawn animation that we associate with Ghibli. So this is a bit of a new direction for the studio, but it is under their banner. And I must admit, I quite enjoyed it, actually. It's a bit offbeat, and it has some strange story directions, but, you know, maybe that novelty of being in the cinema hasn't worn off, because I really quite enjoyed watching it. Mm, great. Have you been tempted to the cinema?
I haven't been. I think it's just because there's nothing on that I want to go and see.
Yeah, it's a really mixed bag what's out at the minute, isn't it?
I think when I do go, I think it'll be something that I'm really excited about, and that I will probably go to one of the old cinemas to watch and make an event of it.
That's a good idea. Yeah, no, that's actually a really good plan, because you will get a chance to either see something really classic or something that's quite new, and you can go somewhere like the Cottage Road. I mean, you can't go to the Hyde Park at the moment, but I think they're still kind of presenting films at City Varieties under the Hyde Park.
Yes.
Kind of festival, film festival banner.
That looks amazing. I really should, like, make an effort to go there.
I've not done it either.
Yeah.
I bet it's good.
I saw some pictures of the inside and it just looks... I mean, I've been to the theatre there, but it looks like an amazing venue for the cinema. So yeah, maybe I'll wait till they show, like, a rerun of an old movie.
Definitely.
Something. Yeah. Cool. Okay, well, that's that. Thank you so, so much for being my first guest.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for sharing that quite terrifying story.
Yeah. I'm not looking forward to editing my ums and ahs out, but...
you can't, you have to leave them in. That's part of the story.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope I did the first episode justice. So thank you very much, Ross.
And thank you very much.
End it there. Bye.
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 Bye. Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.
Did I record on my phone? I did. It's quite long.
How long were we talking for?
52 minutes. Well, that's actually short.
Wow, well done you for getting to the end. Thank you so, so much for listening. Now, as promised, some sources for today's podcast. So I will have an Acast page, which will be linked in the show notes of whichever app you're listening to this podcast on. On the Acast page, there will be references, links, blog posts, photographs, all that good stuff to go along with each episode. We also have a Twitter page, which is at No Heathen Land, so come and say hello on there. I'll be sharing some pictures, etc. on there too. A huge thanks to my first guest, Ross, for today's episode. You can find him on Instagram and on Twitter. His handle is at RossHorsefly for both of those. There's a couple of people that I want to say thank you to at the end of this podcast. So the first is Luke, who has helped me immensely with editing this first podcast after a huge disaster where I lost a lot of audio, so thank you so much. Luke also did the beautiful artwork for this podcast. You can find him on Instagram at ionyTOMMI, where you should go and check out the rest of his fantastic artwork. I'd also like to say thank you to my friend Sean, who lent me a microphone to record my first few podcasts. I'm just eternally grateful, and thank you for all your encouragement. You can find Sean on Instagram at warehouse606. He is a fantastic digital creative and photographer, and he also has a podcast called Leeds Echoes, so go check that out if you like Leeds history. You will not be disappointed. Thank you so much for listening, and I will see you next time.